We've been looking at the book of Esther. And it's unique in the Bible in the fact that it never mentions God directly. It's the only book in the Bible that doesn't mention the name of God directly. And it deals with a threat to God's people who were in exile at this time. They were living under foreign rule, under the Persian Empire. And what we do see is that even though God isn't mentioned, he is the unseen God through the whole of this book. God is guiding and directing things all the way through this book. And we see that as the story unfolds, we can see, if you like, the providence of God being worked out in this whole, in the events of this book. Esther was a Jew, had been made queen, and placed in the royal palace. And her cousin Mordecai reminds her, doesn't he, that she's there for a reason. He said, remember last time we looked at the fact, he said to her, you know, maybe God's put you there. Well, he didn't say God, but he said, maybe you're there for such a time as this, for a reason. And, you know, God places us where we are for a reason. He puts us where we are for a purpose. And we're to make sure that we follow the plans and the purposes of God, aren't we? She there had the potential to help her people out. She was in a position of some influence in the palace. But this came with no small risk, did it? If she was going to go to the king and ask for help, as Mordecai requested of her, as we saw last time at the end of chapter 4, there was a risk involved for her. She had a dilemma, didn't she? And we left Esther last time, a few weeks ago, on a bit of a cliffhanger, didn't we? What was going to happen to Esther? What was she going to do? Would her life be in danger by going to see the king unannounced? And we saw, didn't we, this in the previous passage there in chapter 4, how God's plans start to come to fruition. How we see Esther in that position for this purpose and for this reason. And it was no easy path for her to take, was it? Because Esther needed to be obedient even to the point of sacrifice. She realised that by going to the king unannounced, her life could be forfeit. And she was willing to do that, to serve God and her people. We also saw, didn't we, that this was a foreshadow of what Christ did for us. We saw, didn't we, how when Christ came to bring salvation to his people, that the course he had to take was one of sacrifice. He had to give himself in obedience to God the Father. He had to give himself up to sacrifice. He didn't shrink back from the cross at Calvary. He followed the will of God. He followed the path of obedience. So what Esther does here is a foreshadow of what Christ has done for us as well. And also we learned, didn't we, that what Esther and Christ have both done, we are all expected to do. We must all face the cost of discipleship. All of us no longer own our lives. We trusted in God as our Saviour. Our lives are no longer our own. They are God's, and they're his to do with what he wills. So this week, we're going to see what happens as Esther approaches the king. Esther and Mordecai, and all the Jews in Susa, had fasted for 3 days in preparation. And she comes in her royal robes, doesn't she, before the king. She'd been getting prepared. She'd been fasting and praying for 3 days along with all the Jews. And now it came for the time for Esther to take her life in her hands, really. And she makes every effort, doesn't she, to approach the king appropriately. She does what she should do. She dresses herself in her royal robes. She gets ready and approaches the king properly. She does the best she can when she comes into the presence of the king. She makes sure that there's nothing about her appearance that is going to cause offence. There's nothing about the way she approaches the king that is going to cause offence. So these royal robes are her way of preparing herself to meet with the king, but also a reminder, aren't they, of her royal status. She was the queen, after all. She did have some status in the palace. So she puts on her royal robes, and she goes on and stands in the inner court in front of the king's hall. She was clearly in view of the king. But she didn't just rush in to his presence. She didn't sort of burst in rudely and make a scene. She went and stood where he could see her, but she also showed that she had humility. She demonstrated humility as she came before the king. The action she did made the point that she desired an audience, but without being intrusive. And I guess it was at this point that maybe her heart was in her mouth, because she didn't know how the king was going to react. She couldn't be sure, could she, of how the king was going to react. Would he see this as an act of defiance, that his queen should come unannounced? Similar to that of Queen Vashti. Remember, she refused to come when she was commanded. An act of defiance. And now Esther is coming when she's not been commanded, which could also be seen as an act of defiance. Esther has no idea what sort of mood he might be in today. He might have had a bad morning and be very unhappy. And he might not want to see anybody. She wasn't to know that, was she? So she waits to see her fate. And we see here that it's the king's mercy that is required. It's the king's mercy that is required. You see, by coming unannounced, she actually, according to the law, stands condemned already. Entering the king's presence without permission meant execution. And she actually stands condemned because of what she's done. The only thing that could save her is the king's mercy. Only if he extended the scepter to her to show that he was willing for her to be there, could her life be spared. The penalty for coming unannounced was death. And only the action of the king could make a difference to that. I was reading in one of my commentaries, I was preparing for this, that in excavations around Persepolis, they found various depictions of the court of the king. And one of them shows the king flanked by various officials, including a soldier with an axe. And one of the historians recounts that if indeed somebody entered the king's presence without permission, the judgment was swift. It happened straight away. This is one of the things they've dug up there. This is actually Darius, Xerxes' father, and Xerxes is standing behind him. And just behind them, there's some soldiers at the back. It's all broken off at the top, so we can't see what they're actually carrying, but it's quite likely those were the people that would put people to death who entered the king's presence unannounced. And it would happen just like that. There was no time for a court case. There was no appeal. That was it. And that's what would have happened to Esther had the king not held out his scepter. So Esther was in a precarious position, wasn't she, at this point? It was a very precarious position for her to be in. She couldn't be certain of what the king would do. However, the king does extend his scepter to her, doesn't he? What are we told? We're told he was pleased to see her. Pleased to see her. Or she found favour in the eyes of the king. He was happy that she'd come along. He was pleased to see her. Perhaps he'd been having a bad morning, and this cheered him up, seeing his beautiful queen arriving in her royal robes. Perhaps that made him feel much better about the whole day. But he was pleased to see her. And he willingly extends the scepter to show her that mercy, to save her life. This isn't the king simply begrudgingly allowing Esther to come before him. It's also something he desires. He wanted her to be there. He was pleased that she turned up, genuinely pleased to see her. And I guess he was also very aware of the danger she put herself in. He knew what the law was. He knew that her turning up there unannounced was very dangerous for her. So he also knew that whatever she wanted to say must be very important. And so he's willing to hear what she's got to say. And he's willing to grant the request that she has. He says, doesn't he, that she can have anything she wants, including up to half the kingdom. I guess that's sort of reminiscent of King Herod in the New Testament. Remember when Herodias' daughter danced before Herod? He was so pleased, he said, you can have anything you want, even up to half my kingdom. Of course, Herod's offer was fueled by wine, excessive wine. And it's possible that Xerxes' offer here was made out of love. But actually, it's more likely it's a tradition aimed at showing how generous he was. It's highly unlikely he intended to give her half the kingdom. There's a historian called Herodotus who also records another instance where Xerxes does the same thing, makes such an offer to somebody else, not with the intention of ever giving away half his kingdom, but it's just a way, a tradition, a way they showed how generous they were willing to be, how much they were willing to grant what the person requested. So it demonstrates to us here that the king is really keen and willing to grant Esther's request. And he doesn't even know what it is yet. So what is Esther's request? Well, she doesn't tell him, actually. She doesn't say what her request actually is. But instead, she says, I'd prefer it if you and Haman could come along to a banquet that I've prepared. And the king, I suppose, thought, well, that's okay. It's lunchtime. We'll go and have a nice, some food. We'll enjoy a bit of hospitality. And it could have been as well, of course, that the court where the king was quite a public place. He had probably many people there, servants and other people, who would have been listening in to what was going on. But the banquet would have been a much more private affair. And maybe he's thinking, well, she wants to ask me something she doesn't want anybody else to hear. So maybe that's why she's invited me to a banquet. And he probably thought Haman had been invited because of his new position. I mean, he just got this great promotion, hadn't he? Second only to the king. He had this respect due to him. So he probably thinks, well, Haman's been invited because of the respect for who he is and for his new position, for the promotion he's had. So they go off to the banquet. And at the banquet, the king again, he's having a good time, and he says to her again, what is it you want? You can have anything you want. You know, I'll give you whatever you request, even up to half my kingdom, he says again, showing how really generous a king he is. And he says, you know, doesn't matter, it's yours, whatever you ask for. But Esther doesn't tell him again. She doesn't say what's on her mind. But she simply says, well, if I've found favour in your eyes, she says, if you're happy with me, would you indulge me a bit further and come along to another banquet that I've prepared with Haman tomorrow? Now, that may have been a bit of a risky strategy. I don't know about you, but I wonder, well, why didn't she just sort of get on with it then? Twice he's offered her half a kingdom. Twice he's made the point that he's going to give her anything she wants. He's going to answer her request. He's in a good mood. He's had a nice bit of food and drink. Why not ask him now? But she doesn't. She decides that she's going to leave it a bit longer and wait until tomorrow. We don't really know what her reasons were. We're not told what her reasons were. What we do know as we carry on the story, which we'll see in weeks to come, that it was all part of God's timing. This is what God wanted. This was the perfect timing that God had chosen. Maybe Esther wanted that little bit more assurance that the king was willing to do what he said. Maybe she wanted him to say it a third time, and so that he couldn't go back on what he said. I don't know. I mean, what she wanted the king to do was actually not an easy thing, was it, if you think about it? You think what she was asking this king to do, or she was going to ask this king to do. She was taking a huge risk in asking him. There was going to be a cost for what she wanted, wasn't there? A big cost. Not just to her, either. She was, in fact, asking him to reverse an irreversible law. The law that had been passed could not be changed. Those laws were, once the laws were set, that was it. They could not be changed. So in some way, she's asking King Xerxes to reverse an irreversible law, to say that the Jews were not going to be attacked and slaughtered as Haman had requested. This law had been set in place by Haman and signed and sealed by the king, the two most powerful men in the kingdom. And by the laws of the Medes and Persians, it couldn't be changed. So she was asking for something really impossible. And just supposing the king had found a way to grant her request, would he really want to? Because if he did, he's going to lose an enormous sum of money, because he's only getting the money Haman promised him, didn't he? Was it 10,000 talents, I think, an awful lot of money into his treasury. He's only getting that because he passed this law. So it's quite likely if he went back on it, if he could go back on it, he's going to lose some money. It's going to cost him something too. It's also going to cost Esther, because she would have to reveal her Jewish heritage. She'd have to let them know why she was asking this, why she was so concerned for the Jews. And that, again, could be something which counted against her. So this was not a request to be rushed into. She wanted to make sure that she was in the best possible position before speaking. And she shows deference to the king, doesn't she, by once again humbling herself and seeking his permission that she could have this banquet the next day. Well, the king and Haman are all too happy to come to have a banquet the next day, so they comply and they accede to her request. I want us just for a minute to think about these things, the things surrounding what went on here, and think about what it means to approach the king, our king. I'm referring to God here, of course, because there are some parallels in this passage to the way that we need to approach God. How should we behave when we come before the king? Firstly, let me say this. All of us will have to stand before the king. All of us will have to stand before God. You know, I've heard people say very often, it doesn't matter which religion you choose to believe in, because ultimately, all roads lead to God, don't they? It doesn't matter what you choose to believe in, ultimately all roads lead to God. And actually, that's very true. That is very true. All roads do lead to God. They lead to his judgment seat. But only one road leads to heaven. It doesn't matter what religion you believe in, you will end up before the throne of God. But whether you are judged and condemned, or whether you are sent for eternal life, depends on one path that must be chosen. We all will stand before the living God, and we must come appropriately. We must come with the right attitude. We must come in humility. We have to acknowledge our position before God. We are sinful people who deserve nothing less than his judgment. Just turn with me, if you would, to Matthew 22 for a moment. And there we find the parable of the wedding banquet at the start of Matthew 22. Let's just read those verses together. Matthew 22, verse 1. Jesus spoke to them again in parables, saying, "The kingdom of heaven is like a king who prepared a wedding banquet for his son. He sent his servants to those who had been invited to the banquet to tell them to come, but they refused to come. Then he sent some more servants and said, 'Tell those who have been invited that I've prepared my dinner. My oxen and fatted cattle have been slaughtered, and everything is ready. Come to the wedding banquet.' But they paid no attention and went off, one to his field, another to his business. The rest seized his servants, ill-treated them and killed them. The king was enraged. He sent his army and destroyed those murderers and burned their city. Then he said to his servants, 'The wedding banquet is ready, but those I invited did not deserve to come. Go to the street corners and invite to the banquet anyone you find.' So the servants went out into the streets and gathered all the people they could find, both good and bad, and the wedding hall was filled with guests. But when the king came in to see the guests, he noticed a man there who was not wearing wedding clothes. 'Friend,' he asked, 'how did you get in here without wedding clothes?' The man was speechless. Then the king told the attendants, 'Tie him hand and foot and throw him outside into the darkness, where there will be a weeping and gnashing of teeth. For many are invited, but few are chosen.'" The man who turned up without the right clothes on was kicked out, wasn't he? He wasn't one of the guests. You see, we, like Esther, have to have the right clothing when we meet with God. We have to come in royal robes if we're going to be accepted. Now, I'm not talking about what we wear to church. Otherwise, I'd be in big trouble. That's a cultural thing. When I was in Africa, and you will hear that phrase quite a lot in the future, when I was in Africa and I went to the various places, the cultures were different. What they wore to church was different. It was different in Ghana and Uganda and Malawi and Kenya. They had different ideas. It was a cultural thing. We're not talking here about what we wear to church. We're talking about what is acceptable to come into God's presence, to meet with the Holy God when we stand before him on the day of judgment. What is acceptable? Revelation tells us, doesn't it, that those who are acceptable and are in heaven stand dressed in white robes. The church at Laodicea was urged to purchase from Jesus white clothes to wear, Revelation chapter 3, verse 18. And in Revelation 7, we hear of the great multitude standing before the throne of God, dressed in white robes that have been washed in the blood of the Lamb. These are royal robes, pure and clean. You know, if you think of a picture where we all start off with a nice clean robe, if you like, spiritually speaking, the second we commit one sin, the moment we do one thing wrong, the moment we're disobedient to God, a stain appears on those white robes. And they're no longer white robes, are they? One stain is all it takes. That's all it takes to remove the cleanliness of those white robes. And you know, there's nothing we can do to remove that stain. And in fact, all we do is make more and more stains throughout our lives, isn't it? And nothing we can do ever removes those stains. Those robes will never get us into heaven. So what does Jesus do? He gives us his royal robes. He doesn't wash ours in the sense that he makes everything disappear. He actually clothes us in his royal robes. He was perfect. He lived the perfect life. There's no stain on his royal robes. And in order for us to meet with God, he clothes us with his righteousness. Our royal robes are given to us by Jesus. Let me ask you tonight, do you know that you have royal robes? Are you confident of the fact that you have been clothed in the righteousness of Jesus? Are you sure that when you go to meet with God, you'll be clothed in royal robes that are spotless and clean? Or are you hoping that you're going to be good enough? Are you hoping that you may have done enough to wash off those stains? The problem is, you see, we do all stand condemned already. We stand before a holy God condemned because of our sinfulness. And just like Esther, we need God to show us mercy. That is the only hope that we have. The king's scepter was the sign of his power and authority. He wielded it in his right hand. Again, the right hand of the throne, the sign of power and authority. And the right hand of God is the place of power and authority. It's the symbol we're given throughout scriptures. The picture that we're given in the Bible. The right hand of God. And who sits at the right hand of God? Jesus. Jesus sits at the right hand of God. At the end of Matthew 22, he says about the person sitting at the right hand of God. Jesus wields the power and authority on behalf of God the Father. And it is he who is extended to us to show us mercy. It is Jesus who came to us to give us mercy. In the same way the king extended his scepter to Esther to show her mercy, God extends his son to us to show us mercy. And God's mercy is only extended to those whom he loves, to those clothed in the righteous robes of his son. And then we must come with humility. If we really know God, that's not going to be a problem. If we know how much we've been forgiven, that will not be a problem to come humbly before God. Humility is the mark of genuine faith. When we understand how much God's forgiven us, we stand humbly before an awesome God. And you know what? When we do that, God is pleased to see us. God is pleased to see us. He wants us to come in. He wants us to be part of his kingdom. He wants us to share eternity with him. He doesn't let us in begrudgingly. He is pleased to see us. You know, in this story of Esther, she couldn't be 100% sure that the king would show her mercy. I think she was hopeful. After all, she'd known that she'd been married to the king for 5 years. She knew the king to some degree. But there was still going to be that nagging doubt, wasn't there? There's always that little nagging doubt. Would the king accept her? How do you feel about standing before God on the day of judgment? Are you a bit concerned? Do you think you may not be acceptable? Unlike Esther, we can have full assurance of our faith. We can have full assurance that when we stand before God, we will be accepted. Not because of what we've done. Not because we're good enough. But because humbly we accept what Christ has done on our behalf. He then clothes us in his robes of righteousness. And God then doesn't view us as interlopers, no. Rather, he says, we are heirs to his kingdom. Heirs with his son. We become sons and daughters of God, who share in all that God has. That's what God gives us. That is the promise that God has for us, if we trust in him. And we have the right to be there. Again, not because we've earned it, not because we've done anything for it, but because Jesus has made us co-heirs in his kingdom. We needn't worry if we truly know God. We have an assurance that God will accept us because we are sons and daughters of the living God. But that assurance only comes if you've genuinely repented of your sin, put your faith and trust in the Lord Jesus Christ, and asked him to run your life. The challenge from this story for all of us tonight is to examine our lives, to make sure that we have that assurance, to know that we're clothed in royal robes of righteousness, to know that when we meet with God on the day of judgment, he has extended his son and given us his mercy. Do you know that in your lives tonight? If you don't, can I encourage you to speak to somebody afterwards? Come and talk to me. If you want to know more about that, talk to somebody you trust who's a Christian. But don't just let it pass you by. Because in that song, you remember, we sung, you know, how long? Well, Christ is coming back, and the days are growing shorter. The signs are all around us. If you read Matthew 24, you will see the signs of the times that we're all experiencing now. Let me encourage you to make today the day of salvation.